suburban eastern Australia, an environment that has, over time, evolved some extraordinarily unique groups of Homo sapiens. But today, we observe a small tribe akin to a group of meerkats that gather together atop a small mound to watch, question, and discuss the current events of their city, their country, and their world at large. Let's listen keenly and observe this group, fondly known as the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Hello and welcome back, dear listener. Yes, episode 426, Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove podcast, news and politics, sex and religion. I'm Trevor, coming in loud and clear from regional Queensland, Scott the Velvet Glove. How are you, Scott?
Good, thanks, Trevor. G'day, Trevor. G'day, Joe. G'day, listeners. I hope everyone's doing well.
And coming in loud and clear from Peter Dutton's electorate, Joe the Tech Guy.
Good evening. Hopefully I fixed the audio.
Yes. So, right, dear listener, what's on the agenda? Well, you know, I start the, well, every week, basically starting immediately upon the conclusion of the previous episode with my little Word document, adding things as they pop up. And I hadn't really added the sort of the marches about violence against women until the end, until today actually, maybe even this afternoon. So we're going to talk about that. Bear with me if my notes are a little bit sketchy. And just looking at the number of deaths and just posing some interesting statistical questions. And then also looking at, you'll recall, dear listener, that I was very pleased to see from the Australian Bureau of Statistics that crime rates generally across the country were down. And so it's been one of my favourite things of late is to say to people, you realise crime rates are down. And last week, between last week and now, maybe it was somewhere in there, a report came out from the Courier Mail which was reporting statistics from the Queensland Bureau of Statistics or whatever it's called, detailing crime rates in Queensland, which seemed to show quite a spike, quite an increase in crime rates of around 15% on average. And this, of course, the Courier Mail delighted in because they could then blame Stephen Miles and the Labor government for it. And they've been running a campaign in the Courier Mail for the last 2 years on violence and blaming the Labor government for it. So I was a bit perplexed. How could the Australian Bureau of Statistics on the one hand be saying crime rates are down and then on the other hand the Queensland crime statistics seeming to indicate massive increases? Scott, did you see any of that at all in your about the Queensland crime rate and the Courier Mail reports and any of that come across you or not really?
Not a hell of a lot because I don't read the Courier Mail. So yeah. I did see a front page when I was in the shop the other day and it said something about there was a spike. So,
Yeah. So I've had a chance to do a little bit of digging and I'll try and figure out what's going on. But, well, there's an old saying, isn't there? There are lies, damned lies and statistics.
Mm.
And I thought you were going to say there are lies, damn lies, and murder newspapers.
Yes.
It's one of those things. I did see this car sticker years ago. It says, is it true or did you read it in the Courier Mail?
I'd love a car sticker like that. Yeah. So I'll try and explain that and maybe we'll do a bit more on Israel and Gaza and maybe a little bit about China and US complaints about China being sort of having overcapacity and the desire of the USA to start imposing tariffs and other protections and look at the history of the United States of America in relation to tariffs. So that's where we're heading. See how far we go. If you're in the chat room, say hello. Looks like Joel's there. Joel, you had a really good one at the end of last week's. We didn't make it. It was something about a pyramid scheme or something. It was a good comment. We just missed it, but if you're in the chat room, say hello. We will try and incorporate your comments. And so look, I turned on the – do you guys watch like the 6 o'clock news?
No, I watch the ABC streamed.
Okay. So you watch the ABC news bulletin that
– Yeah, I do. They stream.
Yeah. Joe, do you watch any news?
I don't watch TV.
Right. Okay. I just thought you might somewhere along the track.
I use Apple News, which has all sorts of news feeds coming into it, but not TV.
Right. Okay. There you go. Well, I do. Not always, but, you know. So Sunday night, turned it on, Channel 7, and, of course, the first item was showing, you know, demonstrations before sort of the explanation came through, and it just showed thousands of people marching in the streets. And I thought to myself, fantastic, Australians are finally complaining about Israel and Gaza. It's so good to see. This will be great. And then I was quite shocked. Well, I wasn't shocked, but I was like, then it turned out it was actually a series of marches organised to protest violence, gendered violence against women. And so then I thought, well, I better pay some attention to this, seeing thousands of people are on the street. What were you laughing at then, Scott?
Well, just something essential Lord Don said. He says, I watch the Cartoon Network on Foxtel. Their stories are more believable.
Yeah. So what were the marches about? And according to The Guardian, 26 women have been violently killed in the first 114 days of the year, according to data compiled by advocacy group Destroy the Joint. They have a project called Counting Dead Women. So that's what it's about. And in a statement posted to X, formerly Twitter, Albanese said, a woman had been killed every 4 days so far this year. So he was accepting that statistic of 26 women in the first 114 days. And more from the Guardian report was protesters said they were horrified and outraged by the growing violence, with figures from the Destroy the Joint's Counting Dead Women and Femicide Watch's Red Heart campaign showing that an average of one woman is murdered in domestic violence incidents every 4 days across the country. Last year that figure was one woman a week. Now, that's the report by The Guardian, and where it says one woman is murdered in domestic violence incidents every 4 days, if they're actually relying on the figures provided by Destroy the Joints, they admit that their figure includes the 5 women killed in Bondi. So of the 26 killed this year, they've said 5 of them relate to that incident, which they call gendered violence. But you could hardly call that domestic violence.
No.
I wouldn't think. You might call it gendered violence because he seemed to specifically target women, but it's not domestic violence. So as I'm reading all this stuff, I'm seeing a confusion between violence, homicide, and domestic violence or domestic homicide.
And also there's a difference. There's domestic violence and there's intimate partner violence.
Yes.
Because domestic violence is also parent against children and also other way around.
Yes.
Generally with elderly relatives.
Yes. We'll get on to some statistics about family violence being by siblings, by children, and by intimate partners. So sloppy reporting by The Guardian, and just as I'm reading stuff, it's sort of clear that the nature of the protest seemed to be about family domestic violence situation of men committing violence against women that they know, but then using the statistic of the Bondi, for example, to beef up the figures. So, look, where am I getting to with all this? Is just let's try and understand what's happening. By all means, gather in your thousands in the street and protest about people being killed unnecessarily. But let's just – I'm going to be giving you some statistics that I came across and facts and figures and other things to think about. So, from The Age, a woman is being violently killed in Australia every 4 days. It used to be one woman a week, but this year an Australian woman is being violently killed every 4 days. So, quoting some people here, we're looking at a shocking rate of violent deaths of women this year that exceeds anything Australia has experienced in recent years. And quoting the organisers, Remember, these are just the women that we hear hearing about. How many women are murdered or missing that we do not hear about? We don't even have a proper funded counting mechanism to tally and record details of women lost to violence. We don't know the true numbers. And the Facebook page, Counting Dead Women Australia, which is maintained by volunteers using verified police reports of women's homicides, is recognised as the most accurate tally of women killed by violence. I don't think any of that is correct, and I'm going to refer you to a government site and an article from Crikey. I mean, there are some government statistics about homicides, so we'll get onto that.
That also, which none of the left-wing media will want to acknowledge, unfortunately, seems to be very much community-based, as in Aboriginals are considerably overrepresented in these numbers.
Mm.
And it's going to be a horrible, horrible balancing act between going in and being authoritarian and ignoring the weakest of the underprivileged.
Yes. What to do about it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Before I get onto that, because Bernard Keane talks about what do we do about it, as I was watching this report, dear listener, on Channel 7 Sunday night, so the lead article was the demonstrations and this reporting of 26 women killed so far this year, after about 10 or 15 minutes, there was another article in the same news report, workers' deaths, people killed at work, 34 so far this year. Last year it was 175 for the whole year. And of course, dear listener, most of them are men. According to Safe Work Australia, 93% of work-related fatalities in 2022 were men, 7% female. So while this news report talks about 26 women killed in violent sort of homicides, domestic or non-domestic, same report's got 34 men killed at work with not nearly the same amount of outrage. I just watched The Red Pill the other day, and that was a documentary where this lady was very much a feminist, and she had decided to report on those crazy guys at the men's rights agencies, and sort of at the conclusion of it decided maybe she wasn't a feminist anymore. And the sort of theme of the documentary was that there were a lot of bad things happening to men as well. So the particular angle in the documentary wasn't that we should ignore what's happening to women, but at the same time there's a lot of gender sort of unequal things happening to men. And I think sort of workplace deaths were one of the statistics that they were talking about there as well. So anyway, not saying don't go out and protest, just saying, well, bear in mind these other things. What do we do about it if we say that there is a large amount of either domestic homicide against women or just general homicide? Bernard Keane, writing in Crikey, gave a really strange article. It was a really odd one, because he's saying that the problem can be addressed, and he refers to data from the Australian Institute of Health and Welfare data. So this is a government organisation showing domestic and intimate partner homicide rates have more than halved since the 1980s. And so that's one. In the article, he's kind of calling for higher penalties, but he does quote the statistic that since the 1980s, domestic homicide and intimate partner homicide has nearly halved. And he says that there should be harsher penalties. According to Bernard Keane, nothing changes behaviour more than potential offenders knowing they're much more likely to be punished and much more likely to be jailed for longer. I don't know if that's true.
No, I think murder is one of those ones where it provably isn't.
Yes.
I don't think the murder rates are any less in places that have capital punishment as compared to places that, you know, Scandinavia, for instance.
Yeah. So I don't think that just people go, gee, maybe I won't kill this person now because they bumped up the penalty rates by an extra 10 years last year.
Yeah, it's one of those things. I think Joe's hit the nail on the head. If you're going to commit murder, you're not really in your sound mind, you're just going to do it. So I just don't think you're going to be considering the penalties.
Mm. Yeah. John in the chat room says, those men weren't killed by women though, the ones in the workplace. True, but they were killed and there wasn't much of a fuss made about it. Anyway, what else did he say there? Oh, he said, yeah, jail them longer and that'll fix the problem. But then he says, true, this runs against arguments about the need to keep Indigenous men and boys out of jail. And he says, as it's noted by the AIHW, which is this government report, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people were disproportionately represented in intimate partner violence homicide offenders. So 27% of the offenders and 27% of the victims, even though they're only 3.2% of the population. So it's a really strange article to be saying, yeah, we need to crack down with harsh penalties, but it's probably not going to be real good for the Indigenous community because they are a significant part of the problem here and we really don't want to be throwing Indigenous people into jail if we can avoid it.
I have read a couple of articles recently that were saying really we need better mental health support and better community support out in regional areas to stop people getting to a point where they get drunk and abusive because generally it's alcohol involved.
Yeah. So, anyway, in the Bernard Keane Report article, he refers to this Australian Institute of Health and Welfare data, AIHW. And I thought, well, I better go and have a look and see what it says. And there's a link in the show notes for the patrons. Now, the report was current as at 2021. Some information has been updated in 2024, but not, I believe, to the stuff that I'm going to be talking about here. So these are 2021 figures, which seem to be the latest figures on family, domestic and sexual violence, according to this government report. So 2021. One woman was killed every 15 days by an intimate partner, but one man was killed every 28 days by an intimate partner, same period. So women every 15 days, a man every 28. And what else did they say? There were, in 2021, 78, domestic homicide victims were made up a third of all homicide victims. So I'm going to use that in these figures as a rough rule of thumb, that of all homicide victims, let's just assume that about a third are domestic because that's what it was in 2021. So in 2020, 2021, 78 domestic homicide victims, 38 were killed by an intimate partner and 40 were killed by a family member who was not an intimate partner. So 14 killed by a parent, 11 by a child, 4 killed by a sibling, and 11 killed by a family member other than a child, parent or sibling, maybe an uncle or aunt or something like that. So yeah, and so females, 25 were killed by their intimate partner, 13 men were killed by their intimate partner. Scott, it's possible, I guess, their intimate partner was a gay partner.
And yeah, potentially, but I...
It's also possible that the females were killed by a female intimate partner as well.
Exactly. I couldn't tell you about the whole domestic violence within same-sex relationships. Mm. All I can go is by, an anecdote is not data, but I haven't seen any domestic violence or anything like that amongst my group of friends.
Yeah. Yeah. So, a significant number of men are also killed. And so did I actually give that figure then in all that? Let me just find here. Let me just give you the figure. So in all domestic relationships, so 45 females, 33 males, for a total of 78 in the 2020-2021 period. So I bet that is a surprising statistic to a lot of people as to the number of men who are killed in domestic homicide. 33 and females was 45. So, and, you know, of the 33, 13 were intimate partners. Who knows if that's a male friend or not? But again, with the females, who knows if it was a female friend or not? But, you know, all these assumptions. So,
interest. US CDC actually have 1 year. So they do a yearly report on violence. And 1 year they had by sexuality of the victim. And, yeah, the figures bear out that actually gay relationships have the lowest forms of intimate partner violence.
Right.
Sorry, gay-male relationships.
Okay, so we probably wouldn't see a significant number of men in the killing of men killing men column there. It would probably most likely be females. Based on that. Okay. Right. What other statistics are in this government website? The intimate partner homicide victimisation rate decreased from 0.7 to 0.2 per 100,000, basically in the 30-year period from 1990 to 2020. And proportion of women who experienced physical or sexual violence by cohabiting partner decreased from 1.7% to 0.9% between 2016 and 2021. So there's just some interesting statistics to keep in mind about what is happening with domestic homicide, that in fact it's a strong rate of male victims in this, and other family members are involved in committing it, and... Yeah.
Is that male victims of other males or male victims of women?
We don't know. It just when it says intimate partner, it doesn't say whether the intimate partner is same sex or same gender or opposite gender. So, yeah.
But telling you you're safer than you used to be doesn't sell newspapers.
Yeah. And anyway, there we are. What more can I say without getting into trouble?
I mean, talking of that, I saw a news headline on Friday, Saturday, I can't remember. Courier fail again. But, you know, boy abducted at knife point, 11-year-old boy abducted at knife point in Logan.
Yeah.
And you go, oh, my God, that's horrible. And then I saw a follow-up article probably on the ABC that said, yeah, he was pulled into a car by people who alleged that he'd thrown a rock at the car. So it wasn't another Daniel Morecambe where he was being abducted.
Yeah.
It was these people had seen him vandalising the car and decided to take matters into their own hands. Now, that's not a good thing.
Yes.
I'm not advocating it, but yes, that wasn't what the headline gave the impression of.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. Yep. Yeah. Headline made you feel that you could be innocently, a kid could be innocently minding his own business.
Yeah.
Abducted, where in fact there was a little bit of a backstory to it, which didn't justify abduction, but just gave
some... No, not at all.
Yeah.
Yes, but did kind of explain what had happened.
Yeah. So anyway, that's the fun facts, if you can call them that, about domestic violence and just trying to understand the situation a bit better. Now,
John's pointing out 49 truck drivers killed in Australia.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I mean, that is... shocking, because that's almost certainly overwork.
Yeah. Yeah, truck drivers.
Yeah, for sure.
Presumably not doing it for fun. Yeah.
Mm. Yeah, but it's going to be overtired, falling asleep at the wheel, and that's a danger to everybody.
Yeah.
They die, but also they kill people.
Yeah. Yeah. So anyway, that's that story. Now, I mentioned in the intro how chuffed I was to find Australian Bureau of Statistics saying that crime had been dropping, which was contrary to the propaganda of the Courier Fail. And then to my amazement, the Courier Fail comes out with Queensland statistics showing that seemingly crime has been on the rise for 2 years. And things like in this report that came out, assaults up 15%, other offences up 51%, sexual offences up 5%, robberies up 16%. Only one down being homicide, down 14%. Actually, other homicide. I don't understand. Other homicide down 14%, but homicide up 31%. A whole bunch of sort of bad news for the Labor Miles government. And I'm all ready for my friends who I were talking to before. So you realise the Courier Fail has been running a campaign and that crime's down. Next time they see me, they're going to go, well, Trevor, what about the Queensland crime statistics showing that, in fact, crime is up? And I've had a look and I'm looked at the figures, and what it seems to be indicating is that there was a change in the way the statistics were created or the motivation for entering the statistics. So according to the – now let me just get this straight. Where are we talking about? It's a report. I haven't got the actual name of it, but it's from the government, looking at the government, Queensland government statistician. So what it shows is that according to this report, I'll quote them, that there were three times as many assault victims recorded in 2022-23 than 9 years earlier. And most of the increase, 68%, recorded in the last 2 years. And it says here, since the police recording change was implemented in July 21, driving the upward trend in assault victims were common assault and serious assault. Scott, we can hear you loud and clear when you're typing. Sorry. Thank you. So driving the upward trend in assault victims were common assault and serious assault. But what it seems to be is that a recording change in 2021, and what it did was from 1st of July 2021, police officers are required to record all criminal offences associated with domestic and family violence investigations. So it seems to be that there was a change that took place forcing police officers to record stuff that they weren't recording before in relation to domestic and family violence investigations. And maybe that is what has caused this spike in figures, because then interestingly, the state Labor government pulled out figures for the last 9 months showing that total crime had gone down 1% in the last 9 months. That, of course, was buried in the Courier Mail article about three quarters of the way in very small type. So the headline being crime up, 16%, and then buried in a paragraph was, of course, in the last 9 months it was down by 1%, but don't you worry about that. So anyway, it all goes to show that you can muck around with statistics. If you torture the data long enough, it will confess to anything.
That's the one.
Didn't we learn that in the COVID epidemic? So,
oh, yes.
Yeah. So anyway, I will try and get that straight in my head and maybe look a bit more at that over time, but that seems to be the explanation. And the other thing that really complicates it is that COVID-19, of course, in that period, there was a lot less movement of people, a lot more restrictions. Crime was down because of the movement restrictions on people. So,
well, certain crimes were down.
Yeah. But it certainly had an effect. And again, yes, they say that in these statistics. So right. With statistics, it's always good to compare apples with apples, and that's sometimes really hard to do. Yeah. There we go. The third item from this Channel 7 news report on Sunday night that got me was they reported that our Australian government, thanks to Deputy Prime Minister and Defence Minister Richard Miles, has decided to give $100 million in aid for Ukraine. And as the report, as the newsreader said, experts say it's the least that we could do, having reneged on our agreement to provide helicopters, blah, blah, blah. And I'm listening to this, and when they said experts say, I'm going, in my mind, which fucking experts are these? Like, who is saying this? Who are these experts say? And a little bit later on, out gets trotted Peter Jennings, Executive Director of ASPI, Australian Strategic Policy Institute. And he basically, of course, was the expert who was saying this. And, of course, the average person is not given any context at all about who Peter Jennings is, who ASPI is, how the organisation is funded by the Defence Force and defence suppliers. And, of course, they want military equipment used so that more can be provided. It's got the lack of context. Just gave me the shits, basically. I was railing at the TV. Can you blame me?
No, I can't blame you. I just think you've got to stop watching the 7 years. It's one of those things. I used to watch the 9 years until it just got so ridiculous that I thought to myself, I've got to find some real news. So I went to the ABC. Now it's getting a little ridiculous. So I'm going to SBS.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I don't know about the Australian funding, but the American funding that's just passed Congress.
Yes.
He's actually not being given to the Ukrainians. Yes. What really is happening is they're giving the old equipment that is getting out of date and needs replacing to the Ukrainians.
That's what we're doing too.
Right, and buying brand new with the money.
Yes.
So realistically, A, we're not giving them that amount of money. We're saving ourselves decommissioning costs because we have to decommission this equipment.
Yes.
Because you can't just take a gun down to a scrapyard and say, here you go, mate, chuck it in the pile with the rest of them. You actually have to do something to make it safe before you can get rid of it.
Yes.
So and there's a cost involved in that. So realistically, what we're doing is we're giving them our secondhand goods and buying ourselves brand new stuff off the shelf.
Correct. That is true as well. Absolutely spot on. Yes. So it's not like a crate of cash is sent across to these people and they're said, you know, buy whatever you want with this. It's, well, we've ordered, or we've figured out what you're going to be supplied with and we'll be paying these people and it'll just arrive. Yeah. And it's probably our secondhand shit that we don't want.
It's like going through your pantry and going, right, all of these tinned goods are about to expire. I'll take them down to the food bank. But I'm going to claim the cost of my new shopping against the groceries that I've just handed away, despite the fact it was going to go out of date in a month.
Correct.
Or in a week.
And I'm going to pat myself on the back and go, I've donated X amount of dollars to charity, where in fact, yes, this is precisely what is going on here, Joe. Yeah. And experts say, and that's Channel 7 News drove me crazy but gave me 37 minutes of content for episode 426. So for that, I'm grateful. grateful. I forgot to do what are we grateful for. I'm grateful for Dr. Seuss books because you've had to read books to grandchildren. I quite like clever rhyming books. And, of course, Dr. Seuss is often very clever and it's sort of it entertains me at one level and entertains them at another level. So
it wasn't until my daughter was old enough to have books read to her that I realised how bad most children's poetry is and how good A.A. Milne and Roald Dahl are in comparison.
A.A. Milne?
So Winnie the Pooh.
Oh, okay. Is it rhyming? Is Winnie the Pooh rhyming, is it?
No, Winnie the Pooh. Well, so his other books, he's done a whole load of poetry.
Okay.
And it is very, very good.
Yep.
And then Roald Dahl did Horrible Verse, Something Verse, which takes the historic children's nursery rhymes and turns them on the head. Right. So Goldilocks was a horrible girl who broke into this poor bear's house and broke all their furniture and ate all their food.
I've got to find that.
It's brilliant.
Roald Dahl was very amusing. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Pity about him being an anti-Semite, but anyway.
Oh, was he an anti-Semite, was it?
Oh, God, yes.
Okay, gotcha.
Well, you know, the US is full of university professors who apparently are anti-Semitic.
Yes.
Yeah. John in the chat room says, that's the way it's always been done, the Marshall Plan. Correct, John. Yes, indeed, as Cameron Riley talks about when referring to the Marshall Plan, how it was essentially money provided to American businesses and from American taxpayers. So, yes, there we go. That was that one. Where am I up to next? Israel, Gaza. Israel is thought to be preparing to send troops into Rafah, which is the area in the southern part of Gaza.
Where they're all told to evacuate to. Yeah.
Yes. They're ready to wipe them out.
Well, I mean, if you hear Jared Kushner,
yes,
he wants Israel to go in and finish the job off so that they can get that nice waterfront property and develop it.
Yeah. So these poor people have been just crammed into a corner down the bottom, and, you know, you just couldn't put anything past Israel at this moment. It looks like they're going to completely demolish them down there and say, well, you didn't leave Rafah and we told you to.
Yeah, but, you know, if they stay in the north, they get shot at by the Israelis.
Mm.
If they're in the south, so they're going to get bombed by the Israelis.
Yeah.
You know, I know that we've got to be critical of Israel, and I am critical of Israel, but I honestly believe it now is the time for us to put some pressure on the Egyptians to open the border and let these poor bastards out.
How many should we take?
Sorry?
How many should we take?
I don't know.
Mm.
You know, I just think to myself that we've got to – no, I don't think you actually want them to leave, because you want them to be there to actually be the backbone of the new Palestinian state. But I honestly believe they should open the borders up to allow them to leave into Egypt temporarily. If they can come over there for 6 months.
Temporarily? Do you reckon these are if they're forced out over the border, do you reckon the Israelis will ever let them back in?
No, they won't. But
so it'll be permanent.
Sorry?
It will be permanent.
That's why Egypt never opened the borders.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just think to myself that Egypt's got to actually, you know, Egypt was the first country that did diplomatically recognize Israel.
Mm-hmm.
It was after their failure in the Seven-Day War. And I just think to myself that it's time for them to actually use their long-standing relationship with Israel to apply pressure to them to say, do not bomb Rafah. And if they do bomb Rafah, then they're going to have to open the borders up, let the people out and that sort of thing, and then they've got to try and shove them back in there.
If the Egyptian argument was, don't bomb Rafah, otherwise we'll open the borders and let them into here,
then they will bomb Rafah. Be
precisely. Yeah,
it's one of those things.
What they would want to hear.
Yeah. It's one of those things. God knows.
Anyway, remember UNRWA, which was the UN group that was – providing aid relief, and because Israel said, look, there's about a dozen employees who we reckon are members of Hamas out of thousands of employees, the Australian government and others.
I thought the allegations were actually that they'd been involved in planning the whatever it was, the October whatever.
October 7 attack.
Yes.
I just thought it was that they were Hamas. I didn't know. And I think, aren't all Hamas guilty of being involved in planning the attack?
Idea.
So I only heard that they were accused of being Hamas. But in any event, a UN report has come out demolishing Israeli propaganda campaign. In January, Israel claimed without evidence that some UNRWA staff were members of Hamas and Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and had participated in the Hamas-led attack. There you go, Joe. So the allegation from Israel was that they had participated on the 7th of October. Israeli allegations promptly caused the US and other Western nations to cut funding. The Guardian reported on the 22nd of April, what's that, 7 days ago?
A week, yeah.
That the Kolona report, which was commissioned by the UN in the wake of these allegations, found that UNRWA had regularly supplied Israel with lists of its employees for vetting, and that the Israeli government has not informed UNRWA of any concerns relating to any UNRWA staff based on these staff lists since 2011. That's pretty amazing that UNRWA was actually giving the Israeli government its employee list. The review, this Kolona review, was drafted with the help of three Nordic research institutes. It'll be published later on Monday. Confirms Israel has not as yet to provide any evidence of its claims, and it notes that in March Israel made public claims that a significant number of UNRWA employees are members of terrorist organisations. Quote, the report says, however, Israel has yet to provide supporting evidence of this. So, UN group saying thanks for nothing, Israel, when it comes to that sort of stuff. China update for episode 426. We've just had Blinken over there in China. He's Secretary of State.
Blinken. Yes, he is.
Yeah. Mm. Prior to him was Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen. She was over for 4 days, and she says Washington will not accept new industries being decimated by Chinese imports. Yellen used her second trip to China in 9 months to complain that China's overinvestment has built factory capacity far exceeding domestic demand, while fast-growing exports of these products threaten firms in the US and other countries. Basically, China is making too much cheap stuff for export. That's a threat to US industry. I think I will find a video about this. Bear with me 1 second. Hang on. Let me try that again. A source video. Nearly there. Here's Yellen coming up. Janet Yellen.
What's she yelling about?
Now we're seeing an increase in business investment in a number of new industries targeted by the PRC's industrial policy. And that includes electric vehicles, lithium-ion batteries, and solar. China is now simply too large for the rest of the world to absorb this enormous capacity. Actions taken by the PRC today can shift world prices. And when the global market is flooded by artificially cheap Chinese products, the viability of American and other foreign firms is put into question.
God damn that Adam Smith and the whole free enterprise and let the market work sort of stuff.
Well, she did say artificially cheap.
She did say, yes.
Well, I just think that it's like I was listening today on 7 a.m. They were talking about the Australia, you know, the future of Australian manufacturing and all that sort of thing. And then he said that he reckons it's been designed to be a string of announceables up here in Queensland to try and bolster Albanese's chance in the next election. And he makes a hell of a lot of sense because he says, you know, if we're actually going to try and subsidise manufacturing of solar panels in this country, we're going to end up, you know, we'll never be able to out-subsidise what the Chinese can produce them for.
Mm.
You know, I just think that we've got to take the wins where we get them, and that is that China is able to produce solar panels a hell of a lot cheaper than what we can here, so we just got to buy them from them, you know. Mm. It's one of those things, you know,
unless we, for the security reasons, decide we need some sort of manufacturing capacity so that when there's a pandemic we can make ventilators or something. Like, we might decide economically it doesn't make sense, but just in case the world goes to shit and international shipping closes, we might need some capacity to make some stuff. So we'll uneconomically subsidise it.
I agree with that. But they are such small industries and that type of thing that you could have them, you can have them government owned and that sort of stuff that you just know you're always going to lose money on them. You know, that's no problem at all. But I think that with solar panels, we just got to accept that that race has already been won by China.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. We should have been inventing the technology, not trying to manufacture the shit.
Well, we did actually invent the technology all those years ago, but then the guy left and went over to China and that sort of stuff, and he set up over there.
Yeah, because our government had no vision.
Interest in it, yeah.
Right.
But
yeah. It was at one point in the past, I think it was 20 or 30 years ago, Australia had the largest solar manufacturing industry in the world. But we couldn't produce them at the same rate that China could and the same low price that China could, so they ended up moving over to China. And the guy that was actually over here, he was studying at the University of New South Wales, and he was actually Chinese. He came over here, studied, set it up, got it working and all that sort of stuff, said to the government, will you help me out? They said, no. So he went over to China and he said to the Chinese government, will you help me out? And they said, oh, yes, we will. And now they dominate the planet with solar cells. Like, you know, the solar cells on my roof are all Chinese manufactured. You know, the battery is Korean, the inverter is Korean, but the cells themselves are manufactured in China.
I'd like to see the UQ. Yeah, UQ, we're talking about doing biodiesel, growing it with algae. And that is the perfect replacement for the mining industry, is huge algae farms out in the coal fields, because all you need is a source of water. It doesn't have to be particularly clean, some sunlight and a large area. And they reckon that they can manufacture diesel at around $1 a litre.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which, considering how much we pay to ship it in from overseas.
Yeah, that's true. They have been looking at that for a long time. Like they were using it as a way of, they were trying to supplement the geosequestration. They were saying, well, we can actually suck the carbon dioxide out of the air growing algae, and then after that, they convert it into diesel.
Anyway, Yellen is completely hypocritical, and the US government, because now they're talking about it's unfair that China is so cheap. And they're wanting to impose, you know, tariffs and other restrictions to protect American industry, whereas since the Second World War, the US has been demanding that other countries open up to free trade to allow American multinationals to come into the country, and in fact has worked with the IMF and the World Bank to ensure that developing countries could not get loans unless they opened up their countries to foreign investment, foreign ownership of essential infrastructure, and reduced all tariffs. And now that the US is, you know, looking again at tariffs to protect its industry, it's coming around full swing, because the good old US of A was built on protectionist policies. So, drawing from Wikipedia here, dear listener, Britain was the first. However, its most ardent user was the US. This is for protection mechanisms. And Britain initially didn't want to industrialize the American colonies and implemented policies to that effect, so they banned high value-added manufacturing activities in the US colony. So the American Revolution was to some extent a war against this policy, in which the commercial elite of the colonies rebelled against being forced to play a lesser role in the emerging Atlantic economy. And this explains why, after independence, the Tariff Act of 1789 was the second bill the Republic signed by President Washington, which imposed a tariff of 5%. And during that period of the early American days, most American intellectuals and politicians during the country's catching up period felt that the free trade theory advocated by classical economists was not suited to their country. And the US went against the advice of economists like Adam Smith, Ricardo, and Jean-Baptiste Say. How would you pronounce that in French, Joe? S-A-Y.
Say.
Just saying. Okay. And try to protect its industries. And that's what they did all the way up until the Second World War. So let me see. Between 1792 and the war with Britain in 1812, the average tariff was 12.5%. Then they doubled to 25%. And by 1820, America's average tariff was 40%. And that, dear listener, is how American industry was born, because they were able to protect these industries and get them growing and feeding the local economy. And then once they were competitive, they were then ready to take on the world. And so after the Second World War, with America dominant, they then said to the rest of the global South and other countries, well, you guys have to, what do you mean you've got tariffs? You've got to get rid of those. Free trade.
Yeah, I mean, the Second World War, of course, America was spared the destruction of Europe.
Yes.
And loaned, yeah, I mean, they loaned, they didn't give the equipment to their allies.
Mm.
So the allies were in debt.
Yeah. So it's just a turning of the original roots of the American economy back to some protectionism. And there you go, a bit of the story there. And finally, to finish up with, what do you think of a four-day week, gentlemen?
I'd love a four-day week.
I knew people who worked a four-day week, but it was four 10-hour days.
Right.
As opposed to four 8-hour days. But
see,
yeah.
That honestly wouldn't worry me if it was four 10-hour days.
Well, why not let's have four 8-hour days? So there was an article in the John Menadue blog, John Quiggin, in his post, saying four-day work weeks are inevitable, saying that productivity has risen in the last 50 years, but the hours we put in at work haven't changed. And
yeah, but that's all gravy for the owners, business owners.
Yes. Yeah. Well, he says at first sight that might indicate a 20% fall in productivity as measured by output per worker. But the fall would be less than that because in most occupations there are diminishing returns to working hours. That would be true. There's a lot mm-hmm. of people filling in time, watching the clock.
Oh, God, yeah.
Who could get their work done in 4 days.
I was guilty of that myself. You know, me watching the clock for the final 2 hours.
Yes. So he's got a website you can support. 87%.
Yeah, but you could make them work for longer hours, back up to your 40-hour week, and then just sack more people and save yourself more money.
You could. So Australia's got a bit of a reputation as being a bunch of slackers when it comes to work, you know.
We're not, actually.
No, we're not. So there is a chart here which shows that hours worked per year on with high-income OECD countries. And let's just start at the top for the countries where the people work the most in terms of number of hours per year. Korea. I'm assuming that's South Korea. Well, because we're talking only OECD countries. So yes.
It'd be Korea.
South Korea, Israel, United States, New Zealand, and then Australia. Now, the countries I list from now on, dear listener, work less hours than us. Canada, Japan, Ireland, United Kingdom, Switzerland, Belgium, France, Finland, Luxembourg, Iceland, Austria, Sweden, Netherlands, Norway, Denmark, and right down the bottom, Germany. So we tend to compare ourselves with Americans and we know that they're overworked, but we put in more hours than the Japanese.
Mm.
And they're supposed to be the epitome of a workaholic. And look at the Germans. They shut down everything on Sunday, where the Lutherans take all the Catholic public holidays as well as their own, and the Catholics take all the Lutheran holidays as well as their own. And Germany and Australia are closely matched in terms of per capita income and other indicators of material living standards, and the Germans can achieve that with much less toil. And in fact, if you knocked 20% off our annual working hours, we would still be working longer than the Germans.
Yeah, but you see, the Germans' CEOs are paid less than Australian CEOs.
Yes.
And that's just not fair.
Yes. So there's a good argument for the – that's the best argument we've got for the four-day working week, is that even with it, the average number of hours worked by Aussies would be still less than what the Germans are doing. So there we go. Try that with your boss next time you have a performance review. Dear listener, if it doesn't work out well, don't blame me.
Well, ChatGPT is going to replace us all anyway.
Do you try any of that AI stuff, Joe?
Well, yeah, I summarized some videos with it, but that's about it.
Yeah. I've been using it to produce the show notes. So it's been okay, I think, for producing the show notes and for finding the chapter timestamp marks. So, yeah.
It okay as a starting point. Mm. It's quite good at doing rote work, but I wouldn't want to use it for anything particularly intellectual.
Mm.
It's perfectly good for the Murdoch Press.
Yes, that'd do the job there. But there's no way AI could have produced...
It does do the job there.
Yes. There's no way it could have produced a podcast as fine as this one that you've enjoyed, dear listener, for the last 61 minutes.
Dan Savage, who does a podcast, Love and Sex podcast, Relationship Advice, wrote his intro to one of his episodes with one of the ChatGPT models or one of the large language models.
Yeah.
And it just sounded, it was full of fluff.
Yes.
It had no substance to it. It was very saying a lot but not saying anything of any substance.
It always strikes me when you ask it, like I hardly use it, but it always sounds like, imagine you've set an assignment or a test for some kids. Tell me about XYZ. And there's a kid who's never read any of the material but just uses bullshitty language to try to give the impression that he does by drawing out what he can from the actual question.
Yes.
Not really adding much to it. So, yeah, a lot of fluff and not a lot of insight. But anyway, who knows where it'll finish up. Right, Scott, you've got to go to bed early.
Yes, I do.
Yep. Mm. I've got stuff to do. Joe's got stuff to do. He's got tech guy stuff. Well, maybe not. Dear listener, hope you enjoyed that episode. We'll be back next week with something. Talk to you then. Bye for now.
And it's a good night from me.
And it's a good night from him.
Good night.